Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride. Do you want to spend your sabbatical living abroad? Figuring out all the logistics of moving away for a sabbatical can be challenging and overwhelming. One of the biggest questions I get is how to find funding for a sabbatical abroad. If funding a sabbatical away is on your mind, then this episode will give you tons of information and insight into one option that might work for you. This episode will help you think about and navigate the process of applying for a Fulbright Scholar Award. My guest is Mark Lillett, Fulbright Coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark brings deep knowledge of the Fulbright program to this conversation, in which he shares information about the types of Fulbright awards available, his recommended strategies for navigating the Fulbright Scholar Award catalog, building relationships with potential host institutions, and so much more. If you're interested in Fulbright, you might also want to listen to a few other Sabbatical 101 episodes I've done on the podcast, which I will link to in the show notes. There are also links in the show notes to the Fulbright Scholar Award page and catalog so you can learn all about the different options that are available to you. I hope you find this episode helpful as you look ahead to your sabbatical abroad. Hey, Mark, thanks so much for joining me on Sabbatical 101 today.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Bethany. Nice to see you after all these years.
Yeah, so nice to see you. So, Mark, you and I met when I was a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin. You got to stay in Madison, which I'm very envious of because I love Madison. It has a special place in my heart. But now your new role or newish role at Wisconsin is the Fulbright coordinator. And so today I asked you to be on the show so we can talk about all things Fulbright because many of my clients have questions about how to fund their sabbaticals. So I'm really looking forward to picking your brain about Fulbrights and all the things you know about the program now. Before we get started with my questions, do you mind just doing a brief introduction and telling us a little bit about what your role entails as Fulbright coordinator?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm the Fulbright coordinator here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This is a relatively new role here at UW. I think I might be entering my fourth year. And it's not unique, I don't think, but it's one of few roles where I'm working across all the various Fulbright programs, both the outgoing programs and the incoming programs. And that's one of the really important aspects of Fulbright that I'm sure we'll talk about later is that it is an exchange program. It is sending people and it is funding people to go both ways. And so I'm working with our applicant communities here on campus through the Fulbright US Student Program, Fulbright Specialist Program, Fulbright US Scholar Program, as well as working with our incoming communities through the Fulbright Foreign Student Program, Fulbright Visiting Scholar Program, and that whole sort of array of offerings through the Fulbright program more generally. While that coordinating aspect is relatively new, I started working with Fulbright back in 2016. And when our previous Fulbright coordinator here on campus retired, the early focus was on all of the outgoing programs, primarily the U.S. student and the U.S. scholar program. So I've got about 10 years of working with our outgoing applicants. And as you mentioned before then, I was continuing to work in the funding space, focused on a lot of our internal campus, internal scholarship and fellowship opportunities for both graduate students and faculty.
Yeah, great. And that's, I think, how you and I first connected because I had one of those awards that you used to administer, a Scott Clark Jensen fellowship for an internship I did in Ethiopia when I was in grad school. I worked for now no more USAID. And it was such a great experience.
Yeah. And one of the few programs that was able to offer that support for internships. And I think that's one of the exciting things about what we were doing then and also what Fulbright offers now in a broader nationwide capacity of funding for a whole range of different options.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'd love for you to help us think about, just the range of awards that are possible for, you know, here we are talking about scholars from the U.S. who would want to go to another country for a sabbatical or just a leave, right? You can apply for a Fulbright anytime. You don't have to have an upcoming sabbatical necessarily. But I know I applied for a Fulbright for my sabbatical. I ended up withdrawing, but I found it a little overwhelming to figure out which award was right for me, because there are different types of awards. And then, you know, every country has its own configuration of, you know, do you need a letter from an institution? Do they already have an institution they want you to work with? Could you give us, if I'm someone who's thinking like, I would love to go somewhere abroad for my sabbatical or for a year of leave, and I'm just kind of starting out, maybe I don't necessarily know, I don't have an existing collaboration, but I want to explore what's available. What kind of advice would you give us, or how could you help orient someone to the range of what's available from Fulbright?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some general points to keep in mind, and then some really sort of specific nuts and bolts that's worthwhile considering. First, as I said earlier, Fulbright itself is a whole array of offerings. And frankly, there is going to be a Fulbright available for you at any point in your career, whether it's in academia or professional life, from coming out of your undergraduate experience to your retirement period. And that's just something I always want people to keep in mind. If now is not the right time, if sabbatical doesn't line up, if you're not able to get that leave, or if some, you know, family circumstances come up, 2 years from now, Fulbright's going to be there for you. There are going to be opportunities available, even if you've done a career pivot or are at another institution, things like that. The two awards, though, for probably a lot of your listeners and that are going to be the primary focus are the Fulbright Specialist Program and then the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program. These are both funded out of the Department of State, but they're coordinated by two different organizations, Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program by IIE and the Fulbright Specialist Program by an organization called World Learning. Fulbright Specialist is something that is actually getting a lot more traction here and interest here on our campus, because that's the short-term opportunities. And so Fulbright Specialist opportunities are 2 to 6 weeks long. You don't apply for specific opportunities during the application process, and it is not something that's meant to support your research or teaching. The specialist program, you apply to get on a roster for a 3-year period, and then organizations, government ministries, institutions of higher education overseas essentially bring short-term projects to the roster and to the specialist organization and shop the roster. And as a specialist, you're able to also review those opportunities and put yourself forward as, hey, I would like to go on this program. That's not going to take up your sabbatical or even a whole semester leave. But if you're in that planning process and you're thinking, hey, 2 years out from now, I'm going to be on sabbatical, don't have a particular project in mind, or 2, 3 years out from now, I'm going to be on sabbatical, I want to see if I can get some experience in country, in a particular region, based on the expertise that I have developed. Getting on that specialist roster can be an excellent opportunity to kind of dip your toe in, or, you know, fill some gaps over summer break or over winter break or what have you. But also just develop your expertise, develop your networks and all of that.
So are those paid, funded positions then, if you were selected?
Those, yes, they are fully funded. So the thing to keep in mind about the Fulbright offerings is they're fully funded. They are not necessarily salary replacement positions, right? So depending on where you are in your career, the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Award stipend is not going to match your home institution stipend. It's going to allow you to live in the country that you are applying to and working in But, you know, there are all these other questions. How do I pay the mortgage back home and all of that? And those are maybe some of the issues that we'll talk about a little bit later as well. But if you're on sabbatical, of course, you know, it's essentially a top-up award in many instances, and that will get you there. But the specialist program and the scholar program, both, they're going to pay your airfare. They're going to get you there. You're going to get your stipend. You're going to get accident and injury insurance for while you're overseas, all of that kind of good stuff. So this isn't an out-of-pocket expense at any point in the process, unless, you know, at the end of your term, you and your family want to go off and explore for a couple months. Fulbright's not going to pay the bill for that, but they're going to get you there. Absolutely. So the specialist, you know, program is a fantastic opportunity for you to sort of make some connections, share your expertise, and just sort of dip your toe into the Fulbright world. The scholar program offers, you know, a whole range of opportunities. And as you were saying, it can be a little bit overwhelming. One of the things I really, really value about the scholar program itself is everything's on the website. And they do a really, really fantastic job of giving all of the details on the website. The challenging thing, as you kind of alluded to, is everything's on the website. And it does
sifting through it.
Absolutely. What's really important? What do I have to be thinking about now? What does all of this stuff mean? And that can be challenging. And, you know, it's something that after 10, I feel like I've kind of got a good handle on how to navigate all of that. Do I remember all of it? Absolutely not. Am I constantly sort of refreshing myself? And things change year to year as well. To touch on the question that you asked about, you know, sort of like, how do I get a handle on this? Kind of the classic general answer to almost any Fulbright question is, it depends. Do I need French? Do I need Spanish? Do I need Kazakh? Well, it depends. It depends on the work that you're proposing to do. It depends on the country that you're going to and all of those different factors that go into it. One of the things that I always really encourage, you know, people that I work with at all levels to do is really focus on what is it that you want to accomplish during your Fulbright term, right? So you're sort of mapping out and thinking about, okay, I've got a sabbatical coming up. It's going to be it's going to be 12 months, or it's going to be, I want to do 6 months overseas, 6 months back here working on a manuscript. What does that 6 months look like? Where do you want to go? What makes sense for you? Come up with some project ideas and then kind of back into the award catalog online. And then start asking those questions, precisely because, as you kind of alluded to, you dive into the award catalog, you're going to start seeing things popping up here and there. It's like, oh, I hadn't thought about that and all that. Everything's going to shift over time as you develop these projects, and especially as you develop your projects and ideas in the context of what makes sense to pursue a Fulbright for. But to have a good, strong core of an idea or a couple ideas going in is, I oftentimes see as giving enough structure to kind of tame that kind of creep as you go into the award catalog there. You know, I tell a lot of people, you can't do anything anywhere on a Fulbright, but you can do just about anything somewhere on a Fulbright. And so I encourage people to kind of look at the full scope of what they're hoping to accomplish. A Fulbright can really be useful in supporting a career pivot. Let's say, you know, you're a political scientist. You've been working primarily on post-war reconstruction in the Balkans, and you have, through personal interests, some contacts, going to some conferences, you are looking at maybe doing a shift to a new regional interest, whether it's sub-Saharan Africa, maybe Central Africa, Congo, what have you, or Latin America or something. Fulbright can help you make that pivot. Fulbright, and even without those on-the-ground connections, that long track record. But it's important that you, as a potential applicant, kind of bring that idea to the catalog, because the award listings for Rwanda in the 2027-2028 award catalog, which is about to open, isn't going to say, we welcome applicants with experience in the Balkans or in Latin America or, you know, what have you. But what they are going to say is they're going to say, you know, we're open to all disciplines. We need people with intermediate French fluency, prefer people with, you know, Kirwanda language experience, whatever it might be. The other thing is that in then taking ideas to the catalog, and depending on when you bring them to the catalog and sort of start doing the search, you can then start to understand, okay, what are the next steps for me to develop this idea to a point where it might be Fulbright, you know, fundable. So you dive into that Rwanda award listing from the last award cycle, and you see that they say, oh, a letter of invitation is required. What's a letter of invitation? What do I have to do to get that? And that's going to, then you've got something very specific, essentially to kind of thread to tug on to begin to tease that out. Okay, what does that mean? Well, what a letter of invitation means is essentially you've got somebody in country that you are going to be connecting, working with, what have you. And that invitation is going to look very, very different depending on the scope of the work that you are doing. Someone who is perhaps proposing a Fulbright to conduct biotech research in a lab in South Africa, what that letter of invitation is going to encompass and lay out is going to be very, very different from someone who is doing, say, community-based performance research in Oaxaca. Who is my connection going to be? Well, for the South African, it's going to be someone who's got actual lab equipment and a lab for you to work in. For the community-based performance, it might be community organizations, executive directors of community organizations, maybe a colleague at a nearby institution who would be able to unlock communities that you're able to connect with. And you can't really answer any of those questions without bringing a certain sort of foundational baseline idea. It doesn't have to be fully formed, but it has to be something that you can start with and then kind of, and in that regard, at least, the award descriptions can be really handy in helping give direction to developing those ideas, whether you use them for Fulbright or a professional development grant on campus otherwise, or a whole other award down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this question about letter of invitation and how do I connect with an institution, I also see that as like, I mean, you need the thing, you need the letter, but you're also initiating a conversation with a potential collaborator, right? And a potential host. I applied for Fulbright in Tanzania, and in Tanzania, there is actually a list of universities that you can choose from to partner with. So that narrowed things, right? And so then I was kind of thinking about, well, where do I have my connections already? What would make sense? And I thought about a project, but then I wanted to approach this department and say, is this something you would be interested in? And, you know, are you even open to talking about this? And what would you want from me? You know, what can I contribute? Because the other thing that I've been thinking about is we've talked a lot about research, but there are research and teaching awards, and then there are teaching awards. So maybe say a little bit about that and how, I don't know, how that shapes sort of the conversation or the thought process someone might have as they approach connecting with an institution or a department about a Fulbright potentially.
Yeah, yep. And there are also arts awards, professional project awards. And to go back to the very start, you know, sort of my emphasis on Fulbright as an exchange program, part of your application, as you know, is not only the project statement, what are you doing, but then you're going to be talking about your cultural preparation and why this particular country and where does this fit in my career trajectory. And that is one of the really valuable things about Fulbright and preparing a Fulbright application. whether it's the application itself or this connection to institution overseas, is you should be thinking about it much more holistically. I can, you know, what does the institution need? Can I, should I be applying for, as you mentioned, a research teaching award? Do I want to just apply to for a teaching award? As part of my outreach and discussion, you know, maybe you go in expecting to conduct some research, but as you initiate these conversations, it turns out, boy, they would really, really like you to teach a couple courses to graduate students and sort of lay down this baseline foundational class, which they will then be able to build off of subsequent to what you are. Maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you want to do some of that. But to have these early discussions with this notion in mind of what can I bring? What might they want me to participate? And how would I like to participate in the broader intellectual and broader communities at these institutions? You very much want to approach these initial contacts as information gathering exercises. You don't need to hide the fact that you're thinking about a Fulbright Award, you're exploring options. You definitely want to lay that out. And in many cases, that's going to unlock the doors for you, right? Because Fulbright's a known entity. It's something that, oh, wow, we'd love to have you here as a Fulbright. What are you thinking about? But you also need to approach these initial contacts, especially if it's with people you haven't met before, reaching out with a clear indication of why you are contacting these particular individuals. They're leading a particular research program. They've published articles or books that you found important to the work, whatever it might be. Here's an idea. I'm exploring a Fulbright. Would love to have the opportunity to talk to you about it. And then those, you know, if you start those conversations early enough, those letters of affiliation and invitation that are part of your application can in many respects be an additional letter of recommendation, because you've now got this track record of conversation. Your collaborator in country or collaborators are as excited to have you potentially come there on the Fulbright as you are to join them. The other kind of important piece that I think that just sort of you're broaching the question triggered off in me is really the importance of thinking longer term. Fulbright, you know, I mentioned the idea of using a Fulbright for some aspect of a career pivot. Fulbright loves it when their Fulbright Award is the start of something that is going to outlast the Fulbright Award, optimally with your partners or additional partners overseas. Whether that is a continuing research program that, you know, Fulbright's going to fund the first year of a research program, you guys are hoped to be able to swap graduate students, bring colleagues here, zoom them in for a post-Fulbright conference, continued professional development, education, new language, you know, anything that can be institutionalized, fantastic. But also anything that you see and can make a compelling case for, and that your partners can make a compelling case for, this is the first of what should be multiple steps moving forward, building off of this Fulbright year. It's perfect. And that's what Fulbright is looking for. And it also, I think, helps kind of going into these conversations with that in mind will helps you open up to possibility and to hear and sort of share the potential impacts with your collaborators, where you're really going to be able to generate ideas and possibilities that are meaningful for both parties.
Yeah. It's not just transactional. It's not, oh, I need the letter so I can come and live in a different place and get something done. It's really the start, hopefully, of a relationship and a collaboration.
Absolutely. And Fulbright is as equally open to people building on existing connections and networks and collaborations. And so I don't want to have lost in this idea that you have to be starting something new. You should be building new ideas, but you can also very much take advantage of the networks and connections that you already have to put forward a really strong Fulbright proposal that is as likely as any to get funded.
Yeah, that was my understanding. I mean, I've done work in Tanzania for a long time now. And so I was proposing to to work with new collaborators that I hadn't worked with, but it was building on all of the experience I had in country. There are some Fulbright programs, maybe student programs, that do, I think, privilege when you do not have prior relationships or experience in country.
And all of that, you know, is going to be laid out in the award descriptions. And it's, you know, and this is one of those, this can be one of those factors that goes into, hey, you've got two or three different ideas. Maybe you're looking at two or three different ideas across one or two different countries. How well do any of these ideas measure up against the specifics laid out in those award descriptions? We want people who are new to this country or who are looking at, you know, in particular disciplines or fields. I always want people going into those descriptions with an idea of what they want to do so that then they have the opportunity to make those decisions rather than kind of being steered in the idea generation portion of it by, oh, they don't want me because they're prioritizing sociology and political science applications this year. Well, there's a reason countries prioritize rather than make things a requirement, right? Because, yeah, that might give political scientists a leg up, but that doesn't mean that a fine artist who is proposing a really compelling project isn't going to get the award. But it could be a factor if you're looking at two or three different countries. And so there are all of these pieces, you know, and again, it gets back to that kind of overwhelming, but how the heck do I figure out what to apply for, where to go, all of that kind of stuff. But if you're bringing something in with you, it becomes a little bit easier, I think, to kind of provide the proper context around those questions and make an evaluation, which ultimately is the best for you and what you want to be able to accomplish on this journey. I'd also be really remiss if I didn't throw out that there are a few countries that don't want you to provide any letter of invitation, and they strictly prohibit it. I think primarily we're looking at a number of Middle Eastern and Gulf states where I think the Fulbright commissions and the Fulbright programs in country are a little bit more closely aligned with the ministries of education. That's just the impression I've gotten. I don't know if that's actually holds up, but you know, there are all of these out there and there's all this variety and variation that you really do need to take into account when you start moving your Fulbright application forward. But you can kind of backseat it as you're in the idea generation and in the outreach and this networking and connection portion of it.
Yeah. The other thing that I'll add to that, and then I want to talk about the timeline, is I know that there are some countries that have very specific, like I interviewed someone who had a Fulbright in Uruguay and she works on tick-borne diseases. And I think there's like one Fulbright each year in Uruguay and they already have a very specific project that they've identified. Could you talk for a minute about those kinds of opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of different types of awards within the Scholar Awards. There's what's basically the All Disciplines Awards. And most countries have anywhere from one to some multiple of All Discipline Awards. They might have prioritizations or preferences year to year in terms of fields of study. All of that shift can and often does shift and change year to year. But those are the applicant pools into which you basically everybody can apply. What you were talking about there towards the end are what are called named awards. These are oftentimes awards that are connected either with specific institutions in the country, specific fields, or specific fields at specific institutions in the country. So they might be looking for a military historian to teach at a particular institution in Kosovo. They might be looking for computer scientists to conduct research at a range of three or four different Finnish institutions. And there might be one total award within that. There might be three total awards within that. The guidance Fulbright offers, and it makes sense, is apply for the narrowestly defined award that your work fits into. So if you are approaching a country and they've got two or three named awards, and then an all-discipline award, and your work, narrowly defined, fits into one of those named awards, the preferences, priorities, and requirements of that named award, go for that named award because they're automatically shrinking that applicant pool. And so you're going to be competing against other chemists who have an interest in biotechnology or, you know, something like that. Not a ton of people who are applying to do, you know, necessarily do that with a Fulbright. Now, one of the cautions I always throw out there, and one of the cautions that Fulbright does as well, is you don't want to necessarily try to shoehorn your work into an award in which it doesn't fit. Then you're just lowering your chances altogether. But what you can do is you can think about, okay, I have this broader project. And since Fulbright awards often, you know, depending on the length of the award, maybe the one of these awards that you're looking at is only 4 months long. Well, I have this broader project, but this one portion of my project actually does line up well with the named award and is a good fit for a 4 month research term overseas. Well, then that makes sense to be tweaking things. But again, it's to make sure that you are finding the award that conforms to your work rather than trying to get your work to fit into a bucket that you're actually not really, and nobody's really sure of the shape of. And this is the thing about the Fulbright Awards is once the requirements are met, you can make a compelling case for anything, even if you don't line up with certain preferences or priorities. And so you don't know how they're going to be evaluated necessarily. And so it's really important that you are putting forward the strongest project, the strongest sort of supporting documentation about the reasons why you're interested in working and living and extending your time and connections within this particular country, why it's a good fit for this stage of your career, all of that kind of good stuff. And, you know, again, like I said, make sure that you find the award that fits that rather than try to sort of shoehorn yourself into something that doesn't quite fit and isn't quite comfortable because, well, we think it might be more competitive. Frankly, nobody knows. The Fulbright Scholar Program locks down all of their data. So unlike the Fulbright US Student Program, where all the numbers are out there and put in public, publicly accessible, we don't know how many applications there are year to year on the Scholar Program. We don't know how many applications any particular country, any particular screening committee in the United States is looking at. They don't publish that. So we've got no way of knowing, which is a pain in the butt for me when I'm reaching out to faculty or faculty are reaching into me and saying, how competitive is this? And I'm like, I can't tell you.
You don't really know.
But it's also from my perspective, from sort of the philosophical approach I take to this, I really like it because it's like, you just got to do your best. You got to make sure you find the thing that works best for you and the work that you want to accomplish, rather than playing a numbers game where, oh, there were five applicants for three positions last year. I got a good shot at that. Well, you know, when it comes to that, everyone else would be seeing those numbers too. And everyone else would be thinking, oh, there are five applicants for three positions. And then you see this in the Fulbright US Student Program numbers. The following year, there's like 28 applications for three.
So, you can't really game the system in that way. Could you talk a little bit more then about the application timeline? Because you mentioned that the 27-28 application is coming out soon. We're recording this mid-January 2026. So it's a long runway.
Yeah, the application period itself is a very long, it's over a year and a half. But yeah, so we're mid-January right now, mid-January 2026. Fulbright application has consistently opened early to mid-February of every year. So we're looking, I think this year it's actually due to open in maybe 2 weeks. I think they're slated to open the application in early February this year. Point, when the application opens up, they will also update all of the award listings. And then the deadline to apply always September 15th, unless it comes on a Sunday, in which case the deadline is September 16th. Now that is for awards of the 2027-2028 academic year. So it's a year and a half in advance. Unlike many other Fulbright awards, those awards don't necessarily even have set start dates to them. Some will be for the fall. You know, you can apply for a 2-month award, 5-month award, full year award, things like that. But, and then some countries you might not even be able to start until, like, a lot of countries in the Southern Hemisphere, their award year might not start till the following January or February. So you're talking about 2-year timeline for that. And that can be kind of daunting, especially if you're doing some very specific work, trying to find very specific partners. And one of the things that you have to, as an applicant, you have to make sure that you kind of have a handle on is, don't become overly concerned about details, particulars shifting over that year and a half in between, or even just that year from when you submit your application to when you would might actually start the award. Fulbright is very flexible. You know, the commissions and posts are aware that you are proposing, you're starting your application at least a year and a half in advance. Things are going to change, especially if you are, it's part of an active ongoing research program that you're running. Once that award starts, you may be, there are some of those research questions may be moot at that point. That's okay. You know, so you've kind of got to approach that with a certain amount of flexibility in the same way that you would approach, hey, I'm going to be living in a foreign country for a year that you may or may not have any experience. You've got to be willing to be flexible. Fulbright understands that. Fulbright appreciates that. Unlike some of the other Fulbright programs, and again, notably the U.S. student program, there is no campus, necessary campus role. So if you are a faculty member at an institution of higher education, there's probably going to be someone like me there. We're known as scholar liaisons for the Fulbright Scholar Program. And primarily, we're on campus to spread the word, to be able to provide information about how, you know, how does a Fulbright interact with campus policies for leave, for sabbatical? Is there extra salary supplementation, buyouts, things along those lines available to Fulbright awardees? But also, you know, it depends what sort of support you're going to get. I do a lot of work with faculty members, looking draft statements, offering feedback through that process. Not everybody does that. Not everybody's equipped to do that. If you can find a scholar liaison on campus who's able to give you support in whatever capacity, I say take advantage of it. As I mentioned, the website is fantastic. The staff at IIE that manages the scholar program is really, really good about getting back to you with questions. Each award has a specific person attached to it in the award catalog. So if there are questions, I always encourage folks to reach out to do that. If they're not comfortable for whatever reason, if they don't want to tip their hand or whatnot, I always say I'm happy to reach out and ask some any difficult questions that you might have or feel like you might have. And then they've got lots of webinars and programs throughout the application period. You hit that application deadline of September 15th. Your application goes in. Everything needs to be complete at that point, except the letter of invitation can come in. I think last year it was up to 10 days later than that deadline. So that's the only wiggle room. Everything else needs to be in at that point. And then initial reviews happen here in the United States with US-based academics who are split up by discipline. They can't necessarily do a one-to-one match with everybody who's coming into it, but they try to get as close as possible. And I think there's something on the order of 100 different review committees that they have. So you're going to get people who have expertise, pretty close, or at least expertise adjacent to the work that you're proposing to do. And those initial decisions come out in December, mid to late December, sometimes into early January. I think this year, we just got a notice out that says basically almost everybody's been told if they continue. If your application makes it through that initial round of review, you're known as a semifinalist, and then your application goes off to the country that you applied to. So that initial review is really looking at the nature of your project, achievability, feasibility, you know, how well is it structured, how well have you sort of communicated what you're going to be doing, your readiness, preparedness to do all that. The country evaluation kind of takes that as rote and then sort of looks at the broader questions, you know, why this country, your connections in, your rationale for coming to this country, continuation, you know, how is this going to be a benefit to the country and the communities that you're working in and living among. And then historically, those decisions have come out in like February to May. Mm-hmm. At no point in the process do you get explicit feedback. And so they're not going to tell you why you didn't get selected or why you did. You are just okay. sort of giving it your best shot. Unfortunately, in as black box as the numbers are, the reasons for selection or not being selected are as equally a black box. And you just don't get that feedback from a commission.
Yeah. You mentioned before that Fulbright is flexible. Kind of with any grant proposal, it's always what you think you'll be able to do. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling very nervous when I applied for a Fulbright. I mean, I was a semi-finalist, but thinking that I've proposed to live in Tanzania starting in August. What if you don't find out? That's a quick turnaround potentially between June to when you've proposed to go. So a couple of questions. Is Fulbright flexible with changing the start date if you just can't logistically get it all together, if there's not enough turnaround time? And then also, does Fulbright typically provide support for things like getting a visa or just the logistics of finding housing, getting your, if you have dependents, getting them there, that sort of thing?
Yep. And I'll give you the classic Fulbright answer.
It depends.
Now, for the most part, I have not had anybody report upstream to me that a commission or a post was being inflexible on, hey, I found out 18 days before I was supposed to go, I can't go, boom, my Fulbright's gone away. I haven't heard anything like that. You know, this is all run by people who want to have the program succeed and want to have you succeed as a Fulbrighter. And so, you know, COVID was an incredible test of kind of that ethic. And I think there was a lot of just a really heightened awareness of, hey, we can bend here to be able to get things done. And especially if you're looking at compressed notification from notification to actual departure deadlines, they're almost always pretty flexible. Not every country is going to be, and especially if, say, you're doing a teaching, or you've proposed a teaching award, right? And it might not be Fulbright. It might be your host institution. We can't have you teach that course in the spring that you were going to teach in the fall, you know, things like along those lines. Typically, for things like that, there's give, there's bend. You're working with your commission or your post contact in the country, and you're going to iron out those details and things. And ultimately, it might be that you do have to turn it down, or something comes up in the interim, or you withdrew your application. Doesn't make sense for me to move forward. That's okay. There's no penalty to that, you know, if it ends up doing that. In terms of levels of support, again, great deal of variability country to country. Some countries are very hands-on. They will work with you on securing the visa, give you all the documentation, lay everything out for you, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, the whole kit and caboodle, hands-on while you're there. The Fulbright Nehru Indian Commission in particular, you know, has sort of a program in Delhi at the start of the program, mid-year, at the end of the program. They bring all their Fulbrighters together, students, scholars, all of that, you know, and they're paying, you know, they're bringing you there, all of that kind of gets up, paying you to bring there. Fantastic. There are other countries where, you know, the Fulbright program is essentially being run by a cultural affairs officer out of the U.S. Embassy. Hey, great. We're going to love to see you here. That's kind of all. And so it's kind of hard to get a handle on what is what if you're not having direct, you know, if you're not taking direct questions to the Fulbright country, a Fulbright contact in country in the preparation of the application. But I think one of the things that can be useful is to kind of do as much of that research as your interest and time allows in that whole application process, because that's also going to help get you familiar. If it's a new country to you or a country that you haven't engaged with for a number of years, it's going to help give you a little bit more insight, which more likely than not is going to percolate through your application and allow you to speak even more knowledgeably, knowingly, and confidently about what you hope to accomplish, challenges that you see, how you're going to overcome them, you know, and answer some of those other questions. As far as dependents go, I think if I'm remembering correctly from last application cycle, I think they said 60-65% of the awards offer some level of dependent support. And of course, that can change year to year, will change year to year, but it is a mostly family-friendly program. But what that level of support looks like, again, a lot of variability country to country. Some it's really nominal financial support. Some it's a lot more support, housing assistance. They'll help you get your kids in school.
Paying for private school.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of just kind of not entirely sure. But if you have these questions, but these are great questions either to take to the commission contact or post contact in country, or take it to them through your scholar liaison if you're interested. And frankly, as a liaison on campus, I'd welcome having those questions because it gives me a reason to reach out and connect, broaden my own connections and broaden my own knowledge base.
Yeah. The other thing that I found helpful is I went through, you can see a list of people who have received awards and projects that have been awarded in that country in the past however many years. I went through the past couple of years in Tanzania and I reached out to a couple of people who had awards in education, which is my field. I didn't know them. I just found them on their university website. And what I learned is that Fulbrighters are really generous with their time and were very willing to connect with me and tell me about their experience, you know, through the application process and then in country. And so I was able to learn some of that insider knowledge about like, what does the support look like post-award? And, you know, how was it getting a visa? How was it finding a place to live? That was really helpful. And there's so much information on the website, but sometimes hearing it directly from someone like, this is what I did and this is how it worked out can be so helpful.
Absolutely. And those directories for essentially all of the Fulbright Awards are publicly accessible on the website, and they have those filter capabilities. So you can limit it to one country, multiple countries, specific fields. It can also be handy if, you know, you've got questions about what's going on campus to sort for who's gotten a Fulbright Award in the last couple of years from MSU, from UW-Madison, from Marist, wherever you might be, and to then ask them, how did you approach your chair, your dean? At what point? I'm not seeing anything specific in terms of support for Fulbrighters, only sabbatical support. Is there something out there that I'm missing? You know, depending on what sort of institution you're at, the culture, you know, we're both at Big Ten, large Big Ten institutions. We are certainly very decentralized here. We've got no Fulbright sort of specific rules, regulations, support systems in place. So a lot of it depends on what's your chair like, what's your dean like, and to be able to maybe reach out and have those conversations with people who are from your college or from outside of your college can provide some of that insight and information on terms of how do I begin to navigate the campus process.
Yeah. And I should say, you know, I asked you to talk about Fulbright in the context of sabbatical, but on my podcast, I've actually interviewed several people who had Fulbrights not for a sabbatical. It can be done, but it requires a different kind of negotiation, I think, than the sabbatical, potentially, depending on your institution.
And who you are on campus. I've been working with someone who on a specialist program, who's a staffer, not a faculty member, but a staffer, and navigating that for academic staff looks very different than if you're a faculty member. And the other, just to kind of loop back to the like types of awards that are out there, there are also, you know, as part of the program, a number of awards can be what are called flex awards, where you take 1 or 2 months over the course of two different years. Can you squeeze that in over winter break and a summer break, or over two subsequent summer breaks to because you don't have a sabbatical coming up, but the nature of your work and your research and your connections are such that it can be parsed out in the period of these awards, and you've got a little bit added flexibility and what have you. So there are a lot of options to take into consideration, a lot of potential avenues forward for you through the Fulbright program. But ultimately, you know, like I said, time and time again, you want to make sure that it's the right award for you that is allowing you to not only accomplish the work, but sort of meet those Fulbright goals for Fulbright, for your collaborators, and most importantly, for yourself moving forward post-Fulbright as well.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's the mic drop right there. What I love about it is this is how I approach sabbatical planning is start with yourself. Start with what do I want to get from this time? And what do I get by doing a Fulbright? What am I looking for professionally? Am I looking to pivot my career? Am I looking to grow collaborations? Am I looking to deepen expertise? Am I looking to teach in a different environment, right? And be with different students and learn from that. I think that's such helpful advice because you're right. There are so many options and most people can probably find one that can work for them. It's not a guarantee you'll get accepted because Fulbright is very competitive. But I really appreciate that. You know, start with your project and go from there and filter from there.
Yep. And we've been talking a lot about that, this forward planning aspect of it. The more time you give to these applications, the better off it is because it's going to be stronger. You're going to have reflect all of that kind of good stuff. No, if something opens up on August 17th and you're looking at 4 weeks out from the deadline and you feel like you can put together an application, put together an application, right? If you've got the time and the bandwidth to do it, there's no right way of going about getting a Fulbright award. There's no guaranteed pathway forward. We're all approaching it differently. We're bringing a whole different suite of resources, background, training, desires, goals, expertise to it. And if you got to put one together at the last minute, take advantage of it. Do it, you know, because you're in, it may be just the thing that particular year. You may not get it. You may give yourself a little bit more time the following year, but it's there for you. And it's a regular timeline. And I just really encourage people to take a look at what is available, what's out there, talk to as many different people as they feel comfortable. And keep in mind that, you know, regardless of where you are in your career, there's going to be an opportunity. There's going to be something there for you at least to pursue.
Yeah. And by the time this show airs, the new application cycle will be open so people can poke around. Also, I mean, I joined the mailing list, so it's nice to get those updates. Like you said, there are so many webinars. I remember there was one that was so intriguing to me. It was called like Hidden Gems of Fulbright. So they're telling you about countries that you have not considered ever going to. And so if you're someone who's incredibly adventurous and you really want to go to a far-flung place that not many people are thinking about, that webinar might give you some inspiration. So for me, at least, it's really fun to explore all these different possibilities. And I hope that listeners will take away from this the importance of starting with your project that you have in mind, what you would want to get out of this time, and then also giving yourself enough time to build connections should you need them.
Yeah, and this is work that you're doing anyway. You will never regret time spent exploring research, teaching ideas that you're excited about. And if it doesn't come into play this year for the application, it might sneak into a class that you're teaching in the following fall. It might pop up and be something you end up pursuing in a subsequent year or what have you, but you're never going to regret doing this exploration.
Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise. And I think listeners who are interested in Fulbright will take away so much from this conversation. So thank you.
You are welcome. It's my absolute pleasure. And I hope this means that folks will be exploring what's available to them on campus and beyond.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Sabbatical 101. If you found it helpful and want to hear more, please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'd also love it if you'd share my podcast with a friend or colleague who might be interested. If you'd like to connect to talk about my sabbatical coaching programs or to purchase an online asynchronous program, check out my website, www.bethanywilinski.com, or click the link in the show notes. You can also check out my blog, free resources, and subscribe to my monthly Sabbatical Insights newsletter. Until next time, here's to life-changing sabbaticals.